A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You step off a 14-hour journey with two layovers. Your circadian rhythm is a distant memory, and the first thing that happens when you clear customs is a man in a high-vis vis hands you off to someone who's about to make the next 45 minutes of your life considerably worse. Daniel and Hannah landed at Ben Gurion yesterday, went to the official taxi rank, the one with the queue, the attendants, the whole apparatus of legitimacy, and got into a cab. The driver insisted on loading every piece of luggage himself. A few minutes into the ride, he announced the fare would be $150, flat rate. When Daniel asked him to use the meter, which Israeli law requires, the driver became irate, started driving slowly, then took them on a deliberate detour through the most gridlocked parts of Jerusalem at the start of the weekend. They ended up getting out blocks from home and walking their suitcases the rest of the way, rather than let this man know where they live.
That last detail is the one that sticks with me. They've been in Israel 10 years. They know the city, they speak the language, they understand the law, and they still had to exit their own ride home early for safety. What Daniel's asking is, 1, what are the common airport taxi scams worldwide? 2, why does an official rank with attendants create a false sense of security rather than actual protection? And 3, how do you handle a driver who turns aggressive when you ask for the meter? And underneath all of it, there's a bigger question about why the system that's supposed to protect you makes the scam worse.
That's the weird prompt here. Not how to avoid a scam. There are 100 listicles for that. But why the official infrastructure is the thing being weaponized? The high-vis vests aren't a bug in the scam. They're the delivery mechanism.
Let's start with the anatomy of what happened to Daniel, because it's a textbook multi-stage operation. Stage 1, the driver insists on loading all the luggage himself. That's not courtesy. That's the luggage loading gambit, a documented tactic. By handling every bag, he prevents the passenger from noting the license plate or the cab number, and he creates a sense of obligation before the negotiation even starts. You're already in his debt because he lifted your suitcase.
And you're standing on the curb watching your belongings disappear into a trunk. The window to assess the situation closed while you were still orienting yourself to which direction the car is facing.
Stage 2, the rate announcement comes after you're already in motion. A few minutes into the ride, he drops $150. Not before you got in, after. You're belted in, your luggage is locked in the trunk, the airport is receding behind you, and now the terms of the transaction have changed.
$150 for a ride that, on the meter, would run maybe a third of that. Ben Gurion to central Jerusalem is roughly 40 to 50 kilometers. A metered fare runs somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 to 200 shekels. Call it $40 to $55.
So he's quoting 3 times the high end. Stage 3, when challenged, he escalates. Daniel asks for the meter, which isn't a negotiation tactic, it's the law, and the driver becomes irate. That's the pressure point. Most people, especially after a long-haul flight, will pay to de-escalate. The driver knows this.
And when de-escalation doesn't work, when Daniel holds the line, he moves to stage 4, drive slowly, take the long route, make the ride as unpleasant as possible. It's a war of attrition at 15 kilometers an hour through Friday afternoon traffic in Jerusalem. The meter's running, the driver's hostile, and you're trapped in a metal box with someone who's demonstrated he doesn't care about the rules.
Daniel said the driver seemed to be going out of his way to avoid navigation instructions and take them through the most gridlocked parts of the city. That's the route extension scam, one of the 2 most common airport taxi scams globally. The FTC and the State Department both flag it, along with the fixed-rate bait-and-switch as endemic.
So the driver ran both scams in a single ride. Fixed rate first, then route extension, as the punishment for not accepting the fixed rate. That's efficient, in the worst possible way.
And it worked, in a sense. Not financially. Daniel didn't pay the $150, but the driver still extracted value. He got a metered fare run up by slow driving and detours, and he got the passengers out of the cab before they reached their destination. He won the encounter even while losing the negotiation.
Let's sit with the psychological architecture here, because this is what Daniel's really poking at. Airport taxi scams aren't random acts of dishonesty. They're structured around specific vulnerabilities. Exhaustion is the big one. You've just spent hours in a pressurized tube. Your decision-making capacity is degraded. Unfamiliarity. You don't know the roads, the going rate, or what a legitimate taxi looks like. And then the authority gradient created by the official-looking infrastructure. The rank, the queue, the attendance in high-vis, all of it signals that someone has vetted this. You can lower your guard.
That's what sociologists call procedural legitimacy. The process looks legitimate, so you assume the outcome will be legitimate. The queue is orderly, the attendants are wearing uniforms, the taxis are branded, your brain fills in the rest. And that assumption is exactly what the scam exploits.
The most dangerous element in Daniel's story wasn't the driver. It was the taxi rank.
I want to pull on that thread, because it gets at something structural that most travel advice misses. Who are those attendants? In most airports, including Ben Gurion, they're not airport employees. They're subcontractors paid by the taxi companies or the cooperative that holds the rank concession. Their job is queue management, keep the line moving, assign cabs to passengers, make sure throughput stays high. They aren't there to vet drivers. They have no authority to pull a driver from the queue, and even if they did, they have no incentive to do so.
The airport's incentive is to move fares. They get a cut of every taxi that leaves that rank. If an attendant starts flagging drivers as problematic, the taxi company complains, the airport's revenue stream gets disrupted, and the attendant's contract doesn't get renewed. The whole thing is theater.
Theater that we pay for with the assumption of safety. And this isn't unique to Israel. The fake taxi scam at some European airports, unlicensed drivers picking up from the official rank using cloned vehicles or just boldness, works on exactly the same principle. You're at the official rank, so this must be an official taxi. The infrastructure does the con work for them.
What's striking about Daniel's experience is that Israeli law explicitly mandates meter use. It's not ambiguous. The driver's demand for a flat rate was illegal, full stop. And yet enforcement is inconsistent enough that drivers feel comfortable making the demand to someone who's been in the country 10 years and might reasonably be expected to know the law.
Which brings us to the information asymmetry problem. The driver has complete local knowledge, which streets are congested, which routes are longer, what the real fare should be. The passenger has none of that. This isn't just a scam. It's a market failure. Same dynamic as used car sales or any transaction where one party has vastly more knowledge than the other.
And the driver knows things about you that you don't know. He knows. He knows you're tired. He knows you've just arrived from somewhere far away. He knows you're carrying luggage that makes a quick exit difficult. He knows you probably don't speak the local language well enough to argue effectively. Every one of those is leverage.
The luggage loading gambit is interesting on this front. By insisting on handling the bags, the driver also prevents you from doing the one thing that might protect you, taking a photo of the license plate before you get in. Most travel safety advice says photograph the plate and send it to someone. The driver who loads your luggage himself makes that impossible.
Daniel and Hannah did something smart without necessarily knowing it was a documented countermeasure. They didn't give their exact address. They'd booked through the rank and hadn't provided it, so when things went wrong, they could get out somewhere nearby and walk. Never reveal your precise accommodation to a driver who's shown predatory behavior. That's straight out of the State Department guidance.
Let's talk about what actually works, because Daniel asked for tips, and I want to give him something concrete. The single most effective countermeasure is pre-booking a fixed-price ride through a reputable app or service before you land. That removes the negotiation entirely. The price is set. The driver is identified, there's a record of the transaction. Ride-hailing apps aren't perfect. Drivers can still take bad routes, and surge pricing can make the fare unpredictable, but the accountability structure is fundamentally different. The platform knows who the driver is, knows the route they took, and has a mechanism for complaints and refunds. A taxi rank attendant has none of that.
Second countermeasure. Have a local SIM or roaming data so you can verify routes in real time. Open a Maps app, watch the blue line. If the driver deviates, you know immediately. Daniel and Hannah had navigation instructions running. That's how they knew he was ignoring them. Without data, you're just hoping.
Third, know the approximate fare before you get in. The FTC and State Department both emphasize this. If you know the ride should cost roughly $40 to $60, a $150 demand is immediately recognizable as a scam. You don't need the exact fare, just the ballpark. Most airport websites publish estimated taxi fares to major destinations.
Fourth, and this is the one people get wrong, don't escalate with an aggressive driver. Daniel's instinct to get out was correct. If a driver becomes irate after being asked to use the meter, the safest response is to exit at the next safe location. A gas station, a busy intersection, a hotel lobby. The money you've lost on the partial fare isn't worth what happens if the situation escalates further.
There's a misconception that asking for the meter will resolve the situation. It won't. In many cases, as Daniel experienced, the driver will become aggressive or switch to punitive tactics. Slow driving, hostile silence, taking wrong turns. You've now got a hostile person in control of a moving vehicle, and your leverage is approximately zero.
The other misconception is that this is a developing world problem. It's not. Airport taxi scams are endemic everywhere. The official rank at Heathrow has its own documented issues. JFK has the fake taxi problem. Charles de Gaulle has unlicensed drivers working the arrivals level. The infrastructure of legitimacy is the cover, and that infrastructure exists at every major airport on Earth.
What's different is the enforcement environment. In some countries, the airport authority actually does police the rank. In others, the rank is essentially a protection racket where drivers pay for access and then extract that cost from passengers. The dispatch fee model, where drivers pay to get the best position in the queue, is widespread, and it selects for the most aggressive operators, not the most honest ones.
The drivers who pay the most for queue position get the best customers. Tourists with lots of luggage, people who look tired, people who won't know the going rate. The system is designed to reward predatory behavior.
Let's talk about the knock-on effect, because the damage isn't just financial. After being scammed at an official rank, travelers become hyper-vigilant. They're suspicious of all taxi drivers. They may avoid legitimate services altogether. This creates a market failure where honest drivers suffer and predatory ones thrive. The bad actors poison the well for everyone.
And the honest drivers know this. I've talked to taxi drivers in Jerusalem who are furious about the reputation damage caused by the aggressive operators at the airport rank. They're losing fares because passengers assume every driver is going to try the fixed-rate scam. The bad actors aren't just stealing from passengers, they're stealing from other drivers too.
That's the tragedy of the commons in a taxi queue. Every driver who runs a scam extracts short-term value but degrades the trust that the whole system depends on. And because there's no mechanism for policing the queue from within, drivers who report other drivers face retaliation, and the attendants aren't empowered to act. The degradation continues unchecked.
Daniel mentioned the dissonance between the official-looking rank and the chaos of the actual experience. That dissonance is the whole story. It tells you something about how trust works in systems where the incentives are misaligned.
The rank looks like it's designed to protect passengers. It's actually designed to extract revenue. The attendants look like they're there to ensure quality. They're actually there to ensure throughput. The queue looks like it ensures fair allocation of fares. It actually ensures that the drivers who pay the most get the most vulnerable passengers.
Every signal of legitimacy is fake, but it's fake in a specific way. It's not that the signals are counterfeit. The vests are real. The queue is real. The branding is real. What's counterfeit is the promise those signals imply.
And we fall for it because our brains are pattern-matching machines. We see a queue, we see uniforms, we see a system, and we map it onto every other regulated system we've encountered. The DMV has a queue, the bank has a queue. Those queues mean something. The taxi rank queue looks identical but means nothing.
It means something to the drivers. It means who paid what.
Daniel asked what tips we can offer for travelers anywhere in the world. I want to add one that's less about tactics and more about mindset. The most effective protection isn't knowledge of specific scams, it's the willingness to disrupt the script. Daniel and Hannah got out early and walked. That act of breaking the expected pattern is the real defense.
The scam depends on you following the script. You get in, you're tired, you don't want conflict, you pay. Breaking the script. Getting out at a light, saying no firmly, photographing the plate despite the driver's objections, is what short-circuits the operation. The driver's power comes from your compliance with the role of passive passenger.
and that's hard to do when you're exhausted. Which is why the pre-booking strategy is so important. You handle the decision before you're tired. You make the choice when you're still at home with a cup of coffee and a functioning prefrontal cortex. Then you just execute on arrival.
The pre-booking also changes the power dynamic in a subtler way. When you've pre-booked, you're not hailing a cab. You're meeting a driver who's already been assigned to you. The driver knows there's a record. The platform knows the route. The accountability is baked in before you ever set foot in the vehicle.
One more thing about handling the aggressive driver specifically. Daniel and Hannah used a tactic that doesn't get enough attention. They communicated between themselves in a way the driver couldn't parse. If you're traveling with someone, have a way to signal distress that isn't obvious to the driver. A text message, a code word, a look. You need to coordinate without escalating.
The driver's aggression is designed to isolate you. If you're with someone, you have an ally in the back seat, and that changes the calculus. Two people deciding to get out is harder to intimidate than one person alone.
So to sum up the practical side before we zoom out, pre-book when you can, know the approximate fare, have data for real-time route verification, photograph the plate before luggage goes in, don't give your exact address, and if things go wrong, get out at the next safe location. The money isn't worth the risk.
And if you're at Ben Gurion specifically, the train exists. It runs from the airport to Jerusalem. It's fixed price, and no one in a Hy-Vee's vest is going to demand $150 from you mid-journey.
The train is good. I've taken it. 40 minutes, air-conditioned, predictable. Not always practical with a lot of luggage, but worth knowing about.
So let's step back. Daniel's question was about taxi scams, but what he actually described is a case study in how systems that signal trust can be hijacked to exploit the very people they're supposed to protect. The official rank didn't fail to prevent the scam. It enabled it.
And that pattern repeats everywhere. The fake charity that looks like a real nonprofit. The phishing email that uses your bank's actual logo. The contractor who shows up in a branded van and then does shoddy work. The surface legitimacy is the weapon.
The question Daniel leaves us with is whether a trustworthy airport transit system is even possible, given the fundamental asymmetry of information between driver and passenger. Can you design a system where the incentives align properly, or is the knowledge gap too wide?
I think you can, but it requires the accountability to be structural, not cosmetic. The Hy-Vis vest is cosmetic. A ride-hailing platform's rating system is structural. It creates consequences for bad behavior that persist across rides. The queue at Ben Gurion has no memory. The platform does.
The ride-hailing apps have their own problems. As they become more airport integrated, official Uber and Lyft pickup zones with their own attendants and queues, the same dynamic could repeat. The infrastructure of legitimacy gets built. The throughput incentives kick in, and suddenly the official ride-hail pickup zone is just as compromised as the taxi rank.
That's the open question. Can you build a system where the people managing the queue have a stake in passenger protection, or does the revenue incentive always win out? I don't know the answer, but I know the test, when something goes wrong, does the system remember, or does it just keep moving the next passenger through?
The queue has no memory. That's the problem in five words.
Motorola GP340.
Go on.
The radios we used at the Heathrow rank. Motorola GP340. Indestructible things. You could drop one in a puddle and it'd keep squawking. I was a dispatcher there for 6 months in 2004 after I got let go from a job selling novelty ties. The ties were fine, the manager wasn't. I stood at that rank in a Hy-Vis vest and a clipboard, and I assigned cabs to passengers for £8 an hour.
So you were the guy.
I was the guy. And the thing you need to understand about that job is that nobody ever trained me to spot a dodgy driver. They trained me to keep the queue moving. The airport gets a cut of every fare that leaves the rank, something like £1.20 per dispatch. And if the queue backs up, the taxi companies call the airport authority, and the airport authority calls my supervisor, and my supervisor calls me on the Motorola and asks why there's a gap in the throughput.
Throughput. That's the word.
Throughput. So when a driver, who everyone knows, takes tourists the long way, round London pulls up to the front of the queue, I'm not thinking about whether he's going to scam someone. I'm thinking about whether I've got a family of four with six suitcases who need a people carrier, and he's driving a sedan, so I skip him, and he complains, and now I've got a complaint on my hands. The calculus isn't passenger protection. The calculus is keep it moving and don't get shouted at,
Did anyone ever flag a driver as problematic?
A French couple flagged one once. Came back to the rank 40 minutes later, furious, said the driver had taken them in circles around Hounslow. I wrote it down on a form. The form went into a drawer. I don't know what happened to the drawer. The driver was back in the queue the next morning.
So the complaint mechanism existed, but had no teeth.
The complaint mechanism was the drawer. The drawer had no opinions.
The dispatch fee system. Drivers paying for queue position. Was that happening at Heathrow?
Not officially. Unofficially, the drivers who tipped the dispatchers got the better fares. I never took one, but I watched it happen. Driver slips a tenner to the guy on the morning shift. Suddenly he's getting all the business travelers heading to Canary Wharf, while the honest drivers are stuck with the short hops to Hounslow. The system selects for the operators who are willing to work the system. That's not a Heathrow thing. That's every taxi rank with a dispatch model.
So, the rank isn't just failing to filter out bad actors. It's actively rewarding them.
The rank is a vending machine for fares. The airport owns the machine. The taxi companies stock it. The dispatcher presses the button. Nobody in that chain is paid to care whether the can that drops out is dented.
The high-vis vest thing, Daniel mentioned it specifically. The dissonance between the official look and the actual chaos.
The vest is for visibility. That's it. I wore it so drivers could find me in the dark and passengers could find me in the crowd. It doesn't mean I've been vetted. It doesn't mean I know what I'm doing. It means I'm wearing a vest. You can buy one for £6 at a workwear shop. The vest isn't a credential.
The vest isn't a credential. That's going to stick with me.
The vest is polyester. Polyester doesn't vet drivers.
When Daniel's driver insisted on loading all the luggage from your side of the rank, what would you have seen?
I'd have seen a driver loading luggage. That's normal. Passengers are tired. Drivers want to get moving. If the driver loads the bags, the car leaves faster, the queue moves faster, my throughput looks better. I wouldn't have clocked it as a tactic. I'd have clocked it as efficiency.
Which is exactly why it works.
It works because everyone in the system is incentivized to see it as normal. The passenger sees courtesy. The dispatcher sees speed. The driver sees opportunity. Same action, three different meanings, and only one of them is accurate.
Is there anything a passenger can do at the rank itself before they get in the car that would actually make a difference?
Take a photo of the plate while you're standing on the curb. Do it openly. If the driver objects, ask for a different cab. A driver who doesn't want his plate photographed is a driver who's planning something he doesn't want recorded. The honest ones don't care.
That's simple enough.
Most of the effective things are simple. The problem is that simple things are hard to remember when you've been awake for 20 hours and you're standing on a curb in a country where you don't speak the language. Which is why the pre-booking advice is correct. Make the decision before you're exhausted. The rank will still be there, and you can walk past it.
The drawer with no opinions. I keep coming back to that.
Every airport has a drawer. Some of them are digital now. A complaints database that nobody queries. A feedback form that goes to an unmonitored inbox. The drawer is the part of the system that exists to make you feel like there's accountability without actually creating any. It's the most honest thing in the whole operation, if you think about it. The drawer doesn't pretend to work. It just sits there.
The drawer is the queue's memory, and the queue has no memory.
The queue has whatever the opposite of memory is. Amnesia by design.
So if the system is fundamentally broken, and the accountability mechanisms are theater, and the incentives reward the worst actors, is there a version of this that actually works?
I think the version that works is the one where you don't rely on the system at all. Pre-book, know the fare, have data, photograph the plate. Treat every rank like it's unregulated until proven otherwise, because the vest doesn't mean anything and the queue doesn't remember.
Which is exhausting as a default posture. But less exhausting than a 45-minute detour through gridlock with an irate driver.
Daniel and Hannah's story ends with them walking suitcases through the streets of Jerusalem at the start of Shabbat. That's not a travel fail. That's a win. They got out, they got home, they didn't pay the inflated fare, and the driver still doesn't know where they live. The system failed them, but they didn't fail themselves.
The open question I'm left with is whether the ride-hailing platforms that are replacing taxi ranks at airports will avoid the same trap. They have better accountability infrastructure, ratings, GPS tracking, digital payment records, but they're also building the same physical infrastructure. Uber pickup zones with attendants. Lyft queues with branded signage. The vest might be a different color, but the incentives might not be.
The test is whether the platform remembers. If a driver gets flagged for route extension, does the platform deactivate them, or does the complaint go into a digital drawer? We'll know in 5 years whether we just rebuilt the same system with an app.
For now, the advice is what it is. Pre-book when you can. Know the fare. Photograph the plate. Don't give your address. And if it goes wrong, get out. The $150 you didn't pay is less important than the boundary you enforced by leaving.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who has apparently worn the vest.
If you've got a taxi rank story or a question you want us to dig into, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.